This remained true until 1870. End of footnote. In view of such passages, it must be supposed that Machiavelli's admiration of Caesar Borgia was only for his skill, not for his purposes. Admiration of skill and of the actions that lead to fame was very great at the time of the Renaissance. This kind of feeling has, of course, always existed. Many of Napoleon's enemies enthusiastically admired him as a military strategist. But in the Italy of Machiavelli's time, the quasi-artistic admiration of dexterity was much greater than in earlier or later centuries. It would be a mistake to try to reconcile it with the larger political aims which Machiavelli considered important. The two things, love of skill and patriotic desire for Italian unity, existed side by side in his mind and were not in any degree synthesized. Thus he can praise Caesar Borgia for his cleverness and blame him for keeping Italy disrupted. The perfect character, one must suppose, would be, in his opinion, a man as clever and unscrupulous as Caesar Borgia where means are concerned, but aiming at a different end. The prince ends with an eloquent appeal to the Medici to liberate Italy from the barbarians, that is, the French and Spaniards, whose domination stinks. He would not expect such a work to be undertaken from unselfish motives, but from love of power, and still more, of fame. The prince is very explicit in repudiating received morality where the conduct of rulers is concerned. A ruler will perish if he is always good. He must be as cunning as a fox and as fierce as a lion. There is a chapter entitled, In What Way Princes Must Keep Faith. We learn that they should keep faith when it pays to do so, but not otherwise. A prince must on occasion be faithless. But it is necessary to be able to disguise this character well, and to be a great feigner and dissembler. And men are so simple and so ready to obey present necessities that one who deceives will always find those who allow themselves to be deceived. I will mention only one modern instance. Alexander VI did nothing else but deceive men. He thought of nothing else, and found the occasion for it. No man was ever more able to give assurances or affirmed things with stronger oaths, and no man observed them less. However, he always succeeded in his deceptions, as he knew well this aspect of things. It is not necessary, therefore, for a prince to have all the above-named qualities, the conventional virtues, but it is very necessary to seem to have them. He goes on to say that, above all, a prince should seem to be religious. The tone of the discourses, which are nominally a commentary on Livy, is very different. There are whole chapters which seem almost as if they've been written by Montesquieu. Most of the book could have been read with approval by an 18th-century liberal. The doctrine of checks and balances is set forth explicitly. Princes, nobles, and people should all have a part in the constitution. Then these three powers will keep each other reciprocally in check. The constitution of Sparta, as established by Lycurgus, was the best, because it embodied the most perfect balance. That of Solon was too democratic, and therefore led to the tyranny of Pisistratus. The Roman Republican constitution was good, owing to the conflict of Senate and people. The word liberty is used throughout as denoting something precious, though what it denotes is not very clear. This, of course, comes from antiquity, and was passed on to the 18th and 19th centuries. Tuscany has preserved its liberties because it contains no castles or gentlemen. Gentleman is, of course, a mistranslation, but a pleasing one. It seems to be recognized that political liberty requires a certain kind of personal virtue in the citizens. In Germany alone, we are told, probity and religion are still common, and therefore in Germany there are many republics. In general, the people are wiser and more constant than princes, although Livy and most other writers maintain the opposite. It is not without good reason that it is said, the voice of the people is the voice of God. It is interesting to observe how the political thought of the Greeks and Romans in their republican days acquired an actuality in the 15th century which it had not had in Greece since Alexander or in Rome since Augustus. The Neoplatonists, the Arabs, and the schoolmen took a passionate interest in the metaphysics of Plato and Aristotle, but none at all in their political writings, because the political systems of the age of city-states had completely disappeared. The growth of city-states in Italy synchronized with the revival of learning and made it possible for humanists to profit by the political theories of republican Greeks and Romans. The love of liberty and the theory of checks and balances came to the Renaissance from antiquity, and to modern times largely from the Renaissance, though also directly from antiquity. This aspect of Machiavelli is at least as important as the more famous immoral doctrines of the prince. It is to be noted that Machiavelli never bases any political argument on Christian or biblical grounds. Medieval writers had a conception of legitimate power which was that of the Pope and the Emperor, or derived from them. Northern writers, even so late as Locke, argued as to what happened in the Garden of Eden and think that they can thence derive proofs that certain kinds of power are legitimate. In Machiavelli, there is no such conception. Power is for those who have the skill to seize it in a free competition. His preference for popular government is not derived from any idea of rights, but from the observation that popular governments are less cruel, unscrupulous, and inconstant than tyrannies. Let us try to make a synthesis, which Machiavelli himself did not make, of the moral and immoral parts of his doctrine. In what follows, I am expressing not my own opinions, but opinions which are explicitly or implicitly his. There are certain political goods, of which three are specially important: national independence, security, and a well-ordered constitution. The best constitution is one which apportions legal rights among prince, nobles, and people in proportion to their real power. For under such a constitution, successful revolutions are difficult, and therefore stability is possible. But for considerations of stability, it would be wise to give more power to the people. So far as regards ends. But there is also, in politics, the question of means. It is futile to pursue a political purpose by methods that are bound to fail. If the end is held good, we must choose means adequate to its achievement. The question of means can be treated in a purely scientific manner, without regard to the goodness or badness of the ends. Success means the achievement of your purpose, whatever it may be. If there is a science of success, it can be studied just as well in the successes of the wicked as in those of the good. Indeed, better, since the examples of successful sinners are more numerous than those of successful saints. But the science, once established, will be just as useful to the saint as to the sinner. For the saint, if he concerns himself with politics, must wish, just as the sinner does, to achieve success. The question is ultimately one of power. To achieve a political end, power of one kind or another is necessary. This plain fact is concealed by slogans such as "Right will prevail," or "The triumph of evil is short-lived." If the side that you think right prevails, that is because it has superior power. It is true that power often depends upon opinion, and opinion upon propaganda. It is true also that it is an advantage in propaganda to seem more virtuous than your adversary, and that one way of seeming virtuous is to be virtuous. For this reason, it may sometimes happen that victory goes to the side which has the most of what the general public considers to be virtue. We must concede to Machiavelli that this was an important element in the growing power of the Church during the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries, as well as in the success of the Reformation in the 16th century. But there are important limitations. In the first place, those who have seized power can, by controlling propaganda, cause their party to appear virtuous. No one, for example, could mention the sins of Alexander VI in a New York or Boston public school. In the second place, there are chaotic periods, during which obvious knavery frequently succeeds. The period of Machiavelli was one of them. In such times, there tends to be a rapidly growing cynicism, which makes men forgive anything provided it pays. Even in such times, as Machiavelli himself says, it is desirable to present an appearance of virtue before the ignorant public. This question can be carried a step further. Machiavelli is of opinion that civilized men are almost certain to be unscrupulous egoists. If a man wished nowadays to establish a republic, he says, he would find it easier with mountaineers than with men of a large city, since the latter would already be corrupted. Footnote. It is curious to find this anticipation of Rousseau. It would be amusing, and not wholly false, to interpret Machiavelli as a disappointed romantic. End of footnote. If a man is an unscrupulous egoist, his wisest line of conduct will depend upon the population with which he has to operate. The Renaissance Church shocked everybody, but it was only north of the Alps that it shocked people enough to produce the Reformation. At the time when Luther began his revolt, the revenue of the papacy was probably larger than it would have been if Alexander VI and Julius II had been more virtuous. And if this is true, it is so because of the cynicism of Renaissance Italy. It follows that politicians will behave better when they depend upon a virtuous population than when they depend upon one which is indifferent to moral considerations. They will also behave better in a community in which their crimes, if any, can be made widely known, than in one in which there is a strict censorship under their control. A certain amount can, of course, always be achieved by hypocrisy, but the amount can be much diminished by suitable institutions. Machiavelli's political thinking, like that of most of the ancients, is in one respect somewhat shallow. He is occupied with great lawgivers such as Lycurgus and Solon, who are supposed to create a community all in one piece, with little regard to what has gone before. The conception of a community as an organic growth, which the statesmen can only affect to a limited extent, is in the main modern, and has been greatly strengthened by the theory of evolution. This conception is not to be found in Machiavelli any more than in Plato. It might, however, be maintained that the evolutionary view of society, though true in the past, is no longer applicable, but must, for the present and the future, be replaced by a much more mechanistic view. In Russia and Germany, new societies have been created, in much the same way as the mythical Lycurgus was supposed to have created the Spartan polity. The ancient lawgiver was a benevolent myth. The modern lawgiver is a terrifying reality. The world has become more like that of Machiavelli than it was, and the modern man who hopes to refute his philosophy must think more deeply than seemed necessary in the 19th century. Chapter 4. Erasmus and More. In northern countries, the Renaissance began later than in Italy, and soon became entangled with the Reformation. But there was a brief period, at the beginning of the 16th century, during which the new learning was being vigorously disseminated in France, England, and Germany, without having become involved in theological controversy. This northern Renaissance was in many ways very different from that of Italy. It was not anarchic or amoral. On the contrary, it was associated with piety and public virtue. It was much interested in applying standards of scholarship to the Bible and in obtaining a more accurate text than that of the Vulgate. It was less brilliant and more solid than its Italian progenitor, less concerned with personal display of learning, and more anxious to spread learning as widely as possible. Two men, Erasmus and Sir Thomas More, will serve as exemplars of the Northern Renaissance. They were close friends and had much in common. Both were learned, though more or less so than Erasmus. Both despised the scholastic philosophy, both aimed at ecclesiastical reform from within, but deplored the Protestant schism when it came. Both were witty, humorous, and highly skilled writers. Before Luther's revolt, they were leaders of thought, but after it, the world was too violent on both sides for men of their type. More suffered martyrdom, and Erasmus sank into ineffectiveness. Neither Erasmus nor More was a philosopher, in the strict sense of the word. My reason for speaking of them is that they illustrate the temper of a pre-revolutionary age, when there is a widespread demand for moderate reform, and timid men have not yet been frightened into reaction by extremists. They exemplify also the dislike of everything systematic in theology or philosophy which characterized the reaction against scholasticism. Erasmus, 1466 to 1536, was born at Rotterdam. Footnote: as regards the life of Erasmus, I have mainly followed the excellent biography by Heusinger. End of footnote. He was illegitimate and invented a romantically untrue account of the circumstances of his birth. In fact, his father was a priest, a man of some learning, with a knowledge of Greek. His parents died before he was grown up, and his guardians, apparently because they had embezzled his money, cajoled him into becoming a monk at the monastery of Steyr, a step which he regretted all the rest of his life. One of his guardians was a schoolmaster, but knew less Latin than Erasmus already knew as a schoolboy. In reply to a Latin epistle from the boy, the schoolmaster wrote, "If you should write again so elegantly, please do add a commentary." In 1493, he became secretary to the Bishop of Cambrai, who was Chancellor of the Order of the Golden Fleece. This gave him the opportunity to leave the monastery and travel, though not to Italy, as he had hoped. His knowledge of Greek was as yet very slight, but he was a highly accomplished Latinist. He particularly admired Lorenzo Valla on account of his book on the elegances of the Latin language. He considered Latinity quite compatible with true devotion, and instanced Augustine and Jerome, forgetting apparently the dream in which our Lord denounced the latter for reading Cicero. He was for a time at the University of Paris, but found nothing there that was of profit to himself. The university had had its great days, from the beginning of scholasticism to Gerson and the conciliar movement, but now the old disputes had become arid. Thomists and Scotists, who jointly were called the Ancients, disputed against Occamists, who were called the Terminists or Moderns. At last, in 1482, they were reconciled and made common cause against the Humanists, who were making headway in Paris outside university circles. Erasmus hated the Scholastics, whom he regarded as superannuated and antiquated. He mentioned in a letter that, as he wanted to obtain the doctor's degree, he tried to say nothing either graceful or witty. He did not really like any philosophy, not even Plato and Aristotle, though they, being ancients, had to be spoken of with respect. In 1499 he made his first visit to England, where he liked the fashion of kissing girls. In England he made friends with Colet and More, who encouraged him to undertake serious work, rather than literary trifles. Colet lectured on the Bible without knowing Greek. Erasmus, feeling that he would like to do work on the Bible, considered that a knowledge of Greek was essential. After leaving England at the beginning of 1500, he set to work to learn Greek, though he was too poor to afford a teacher. By the autumn of 1502, he was proficient, and when in 1506 he went to Italy, he found that the Italians had nothing to teach him. He determined to edit St. Jerome, and to bring out a Greek Testament with a new Latin translation. Both were achieved in 1516. The discovery of inaccuracies in the Vulgate was subsequently of use to the Protestants in controversy. He tried to learn Hebrew, but gave it up. The only book by Erasmus that is still read is The Praise of Folly. The conception of this book came to him in 1509, while he was crossing the Alps on the way from Italy to England. He wrote it quickly in London at the house of Sir Thomas More, to whom it is dedicated, with a playful suggestion of appropriateness since moros means fool. The book is spoken by Folly in her own person. She sings her own praises with great gusto, and her text is enlivened still further with illustrations by Holbein. She covers all parts of human life, and all classes and professions. But for her, the human race would die out, for who can marry without Folly? She counsels, as an antidote to wisdom, taking a wife, a creature so harmless and silly, and yet so useful and convenient, as might mollify and make pliable the stiffness and morose humour of men. Who can be happy without flattery or without self-love? Yet such happiness is folly. The happiest men are those who are nearest the brutes and divest themselves of reason. The best happiness is that which is based on delusion, since it costs least. It is easier to imagine oneself a king than to make oneself a king in reality. Erasmus proceeds to make fun of national pride and of professional conceit. Almost all professors of the arts and sciences are egregiously conceited and derive their happiness from their conceit. There are passages where the satire gives way to invective, and Folly utters the serious opinions of Erasmus. These are concerned with ecclesiastical abuses. Pardons and indulgences by which priests compute the time of each soul's residence in purgatory, the worship of saints, even of the Virgin, whose blind devotees think it manners to place the mother before the son, the disputes of theologians as to the Trinity and the Incarnation, the doctrine of transubstantiation, the scholastic sects, popes, cardinals, and bishops, all are fiercely ridiculed. Particularly fierce is the attack on the monastic orders. They are brain-sick fools, who have very little religion in them, yet are highly in love with themselves and fond admirers of their own happiness. They behave as if all religion consisted in minute punctilio, the precise number of knots to the tying on of their sandals, what distinct colours their respective habits, and what stuff made of, how broad and long their girdles, and so on. It will be pretty to hear their pleas before the great tribunal. One will brag how he mortified his carnal appetite by feeding only upon fish. Another will urge that he spent most of his time on earth in the divine exercise of singing psalms. Another, that in 80 years he never so much as touched a piece of money except he fingered it through a thick pair of gloves. But Christ will interrupt, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees! I left you but one precept of loving one another, which I do not hear any one plead that he has faithfully discharged." Yet on earth these men are feared, for they know many secrets from the confessional and often blab them when they are drunk. Popes are not spared. They should imitate their master by humility and poverty. Their only weapons ought to be those of the Spirit, and of these indeed they are mighty liberal, as of their interdicts, their suspensions, their denunciations, their aggravations, their greater and lesser excommunications, and their roaring bulls that fight whomever they are thundered against. And these most holy fathers never issue them out more frequently than against those who, at the instigation of the devil, and not having the fear of God before their eyes, do feloniously and maliciously attempt to lessen and impair St. Peter's patrimony. It might be supposed from such passages that Erasmus would have welcomed the Reformation, but it proved otherwise. The book ends with a serious suggestion that true religion is a form of folly. There are throughout two kinds of folly, one praised ironically, the other seriously. The kind praised seriously is that which is displayed in Christian simplicity. This praise is of a piece with Erasmus's dislike of scholastic philosophy and of learned doctors whose Latin was unclassical. But it has also a deeper aspect. It is the first appearance in literature, so far as I know, of the view set forth in Rousseau's Savoyard Vicar, according to which true religion comes from the heart, not the head, and all elaborate theology is superfluous. This point of view has become increasingly common and is now pretty generally accepted among Protestants. It is, essentially, a rejection of Hellenic intellectualism by the sentimentalism of the North. Erasmus, on his second visit to England, remained for 5 years, 1509-14, partly in London, partly at Cambridge. He had a considerable influence in stimulating English humanism. The education at English public schools remained, until recently, almost exactly what he would have wished. A thorough grounding in Greek and Latin, involving not only translation, but verse and prose composition. Science, although intellectually dominant since the 17th century, was thought unworthy the attention of a gentleman or a divine. Plato should be studied, but not the subjects which Plato thought worth studying. All this is in line with the influence of Erasmus. The men of the Renaissance had an immense curiosity. "These minds," says Heusinger, "never had their desired share of striking incidents, curious details, rarities, and anomalies. But at first they sought these things, not in the world, but in old books. Erasmus was interested in the world, but could not digest it in the raw. It had to be dished up in Latin or Greek before he could assimilate it. Travellers' tales were discounted, but any marvel in Pliny was believed. Gradually, however, curiosity became transferred from books to the real world. Men became interested in the savages and strange animals that were actually discovered, rather than in those described by classical authors. Caliban comes from Montaigne, and Montaigne's cannibals come from travellers. The anthropophagi, and men whose heads do grow beneath their shoulders, had been seen by Othello, not derived from antiquity." And so the curiosity of the Renaissance, from having been literary, gradually became scientific. Such a cataract of new facts overwhelmed men that they could at first only be swept along with the current. The old systems were evidently wrong. Aristotle's physics and Ptolemy's astronomy and Galen's medicine could not be stretched to include the discoveries that had been made. Montaigne and Shakespeare are content with confusion. Discovery is delightful, and system is its enemy. It was not till the 17th century that the system-building faculty caught up with the new knowledge of matters of fact. All this, however, has taken us far from Erasmus, to whom Columbus was less interesting than the Argonauts. Erasmus was incurably and unashamedly literary. He wrote a book, Enchiridion Militis Christiani, giving advice to illiterate soldiers. They were to read the Bible, but also Plato, Ambrose, Jerome, and Augustine. He made a vast collection of Latin proverbs, to which in later editions he added many in Greek. His original purpose was to enable people to write Latin idiomatically. He wrote an immensely successful book of colloquies to teach people how to talk in Latin about everyday matters, such as a game of bowls. This was perhaps more useful than it seems now. Latin was the only international language, and students at the University of Paris came from all over Western Europe. It may have often happened that Latin was the only language in which two students could converse. After the Reformation, Erasmus lived first in Louvain, which maintained perfect Catholic orthodoxy, then in Basel, which became Protestant. Each side tried to enlist him, but for a long time in vain. He had, as we have seen, expressed himself strongly about ecclesiastical abuses and the wickedness of popes. In 1518, the very year of Luther's revolt, he published a satire called Julius Exclusus, describing the failure of Julius II to get to heaven. But Luther's violence repelled him, and he hated war. At last he came down on the Catholic side. In 1524, he wrote a work defending free will, which Luther, following an exaggerating Augustine, rejected. Luther replied savagely, and Erasmus was driven further into reaction. From this time until his death, he became increasingly unimportant. He had always been timid, and the times were no longer suited to timid people. For honest men, the only honourable alternatives were martyrdom or victory. His friend Sir Thomas More was compelled to choose martyrdom, and Erasmus commented, "Would More had never meddled with that dangerous business and left the theological cause to the theologians." Erasmus lived too long, into an age of new virtues and new vices, heroism and intolerance, neither of which he could acquire. Sir Thomas More, 1478 to 1535, was, as a man, much more admirable than Erasmus, but much less important as an influence. He was a humanist, but also a man of profound piety. At Oxford, he set to work to learn Greek, which was then unusual, and was thought to show a sympathy with Italian infidels. The authorities and his father objected, and he was removed from the university. Thereupon he was attracted to the Carthusians, practiced extreme austerities, and contemplated joining the order. He was deterred from doing so, apparently by the influence of Erasmus, whom he first met at this time. His father was a lawyer, and he decided to follow his father's profession. In 1504 he was a member of Parliament, and led the opposition to Henry VII's demand for new taxes. In this he was successful, but the king was furious. He sent More's father to the Tower, releasing him, however, on payment of £100. On the king's death in 1509, More returned to the practice of the law and won the favour of Henry VIII. He was knighted in 1514 and employed on various embassies. The king kept inviting him to court, but More would not come. At last, the king came uninvited to dine with him at his house in Chelsea. More had no illusions as to Henry VIII. When complimented on the king's favourable disposition, he replied, "If my head should win him a castle in France, it should not fail to go." When Wolsey fell, the king appointed More chancellor in his stead. Contrary to the usual practice, he refused all gifts from litigants. He soon fell into disfavour because the king was determined to divorce Catherine of Aragon in order to marry Anne Boleyn, and More was unalterably opposed to the divorce. He therefore resigned in 1532. His incorruptibility when in office is shown by the fact that after his resignation he had only £100 a year. In spite of his opinions, the king invited him to his wedding with Anne Boleyn, but More refused the invitation. In 1534, the king got Parliament to pass the Act of Supremacy, declaring him, not the Pope, the head of the Church of England. Under this act, an oath of supremacy was exacted, which More refused to take. This was only a misprision of treason, which did not invoke the death penalty. It was proved, however, by very dubious testimony, that he had said Parliament could not make Henry head of the Church. On this evidence, he was convicted of high treason and beheaded. His property was given to Princess Elizabeth, who kept it to the day of her death. More is remembered almost solely on account of his Utopia, 1518. Utopia is an island in the southern hemisphere where everything is done in the best possible way. It has been visited accidentally by a sailor named Raphael Hithloday, who spent 5 years there and only returned to Europe to make its wise institutions known. In Utopia, as in Plato's Republic, all things are held in common, for the public good cannot flourish where there is private property, and without communism there can be no equality. More, in the dialogue, objects that communism would make men idle and destroy respect for magistrates. To this, Raphael replies that no one would say this who had lived in Utopia. There are in Utopia 54 towns, all on the same plan, except that one is the capital. All the streets are 20 feet broad, and all the private houses are exactly alike, with one door onto the street and one onto the garden. There are no locks on the doors, and everyone may enter any house. The roofs are flat. Every 10th year, people change houses, apparently to prevent any feeling of ownership. In the country, there are farms, each containing not fewer than 40 persons, including 2 bondmen. Each farm is under the rule of a master and mistress, who are old and wise. The chickens are not hatched by hens, but in incubators, which did not exist in More's time. All are dressed alike, except that there is a difference between the dress of men and women, and of married and unmarried. The fashions never change, and no difference is made between summer and winter clothing. At work, leather or skins are worn. A suit will last 7 years. When they stop work, they throw a woolen cloak over their working clothes. All these cloaks are alike, and are the natural colour of wool. Each family makes its own clothes. Everybody, men and women alike, works 6 hours a day, 3 before dinner and 3 after. All go to bed at 8 and sleep 8 hours. In the early morning there are lectures, to which multitudes go, although they are not compulsory. After supper, an hour is devoted to play. 6 hours' work is enough, because there are no idlers and there is no useless work. With us, it is said, women, priests, rich people, servants, and beggars mostly do nothing useful, and owing to the existence of the rich, much labour is spent in producing unnecessary luxuries. All this is avoided in Utopia. Sometimes it is found that there is a surplus, and the magistrates proclaim a shorter working day for a time. Some men are elected to become men of learning and are exempted from other work while they are found satisfactory. All who are concerned with government are chosen from the learned. The government is a representative democracy with a system of indirect election. At the head is a prince who is elected for life but can be deposed for tyranny. Family life is patriarchal. Married sons live in their father's house and are governed by him unless he is in his dotage. If any family grows too large, the surplus children are moved into another family. If a town grows too large, some of the inhabitants are moved into another town. If all the towns are too large, a new town is built on wasteland. Nothing is said as to what is to be done when all the wasteland is used up. All killing of beasts for food is done by bondmen, lest free citizens should learn cruelty. There are hospitals for the sick, which are so excellent that people who are ill prefer them. Eating at home is permitted, but most people eat in common halls. Here the vile service is done by bondmen, but the cooking is done by women and the waiting by the older children. Men sit at one bench, women at another. Nursing mothers with children under 5 are in a separate parlour. All women nurse their own children. Children over 5, if too young to be waiters, stand by with marvellous silence, while their elders eat. They have no separate dinner, but must be content with such scraps as are given them from the table. As for marriage, both men and women are sharply punished, if not virgin, when they marry, and the householder of any house in which misconduct has occurred is liable to incur infamy for carelessness. Before marriage, bride and groom see each other naked. No one would buy a horse without first taking off a saddle and bridle, and similar considerations should apply in marriage. There is divorce for adultery or intolerable waywardness of either party, but the guilty party cannot remarry. Sometimes divorce is granted solely because both parties desire it. Breakers of wedlock are punished by bondage. There is foreign trade, chiefly for the purpose of getting iron, of which there is none in the island. Trade is used also for purposes connected with war. The Utopians think nothing of martial glory, though all learn how to fight, women as well as men. They resort to war for 3 purposes: to defend their own territory when invaded, to deliver the territory of an ally from invaders, and to free an oppressed nation from tyranny. But whenever they can, they get mercenaries to fight their wars for them. They aim at getting other nations into their debt and letting them work off the debt by supplying mercenaries. For war purposes also, they find a store of gold and silver useful, since they can use it to pay foreign mercenaries. For themselves, they have no money, and they teach contempt for gold by using it for chamber pots and the chains of bondmen. Pearls and diamonds are used as ornaments for infants, but never for adults. When they are at war, they offer large rewards to anyone who will kill the prince of the enemy country, and still larger rewards to anyone who will bring him alive, or to himself if he yields himself up. They pity the common people among their enemies, knowing that they be driven and enforced to war against their wills by the furious madness of their princes and heads. Women fight as well as men, but no one is compelled to fight. Engines for war they devise and invent wondrous wittily. It will be seen that their attitude to war is more sensible than heroic, though they display great courage when necessary. As for ethics, we are told that they are too much inclined to think that felicity consists in pleasure. This view, however, has no bad consequences, because they think that in the next life the good are rewarded and the wicked punished. They are not ascetic, and consider fasting silly. There are many religions among them, all of which are tolerated. Almost all believe in God and immortality. A few who do not are not accounted citizens, and have no part in political life, but are otherwise unmolested. Some holy men eschew meat and matrimony. They are thought holy, but not wise. Women can be priests if they are old and widowed. The priests are few. They have honour, but no power. Bondmen are people condemned for heinous offences, or foreigners who have been condemned to death in their own countries, but whom the Utopians have agreed to take as bondmen. In the case of a painful, incurable disease, the patient is advised to commit suicide, but is carefully tended if he refuses to do so. Raphael Hitherday relates that he preached Christianity to the Utopians, and that many were converted when they learnt that Christ was opposed to private property. The importance of communism is constantly stressed. Almost at the end we are told that in all other nations, I can perceive nothing but a certain conspiracy of rich men procuring their own commodities under the name and title of the Commonwealth. More's Utopia was in many ways astonishingly liberal. I am not thinking so much of the preaching of communism, which was in the tradition of many religious movements. I am thinking rather of what is said about war, about religion, and religious toleration. Against the wanton killing of animals, there is a most eloquent passage against hunting, and in favour of a mild criminal law. The book opens with an argument against the death penalty for theft. It must be admitted, however, that life in More's Utopia, as in most others, would be intolerably dull. Diversity is essential to happiness, and in Utopia there is hardly any. This is a defect of all planned social systems, actual as well as imaginary. Chapter 5. The Reformation and Counter-Reformation. The Reformation and Counter-Reformation alike represent the rebellion of less civilized nations against the intellectual domination of Italy. In the case of the Reformation, the revolt was also political and theological. The authority of the Pope was rejected, and the tribute which he had obtained from the power of the keys ceased to be paid. In the case of the Counter-Reformation, there was only revolt against the intellectual and moral freedom of Renaissance Italy. The power of the Pope was not diminished, but enhanced, while at the same time it was made clear that his authority was incompatible with the easy-going laxity of the Borgias and Medici. Roughly speaking, the Reformation was German, the Counter-Reformation Spanish. The wars of religion were at the same time wars between Spain and its enemies, coinciding in date with the period when Spanish power was at its height. The attitude of public opinion in northern nations towards Renaissance Italy is illustrated in the English saying of that time, "An Englishman Italianate is a devil incarnate." It will be observed how many of the villains in Shakespeare are Italians. Iago is perhaps the most prominent instance, but an even more illustrative one is Iachimo in Cymbeline, who leads astray the virtuous Briton travelling in Italy and comes to England to practice his wicked wiles upon unsuspecting natives. Moral indignation against Italians had much to do with the Reformation. Unfortunately, it involved also intellectual repudiation of what Italy had done for civilization. The three great men of the Reformation and Counter-Reformation are Luther, Calvin, and Loyola. All three, intellectually, are medieval in philosophy, as compared either with the Italians who immediately preceded them, or with such men as Erasmus and More. Philosophically, the century following the beginning of the Reformation is a barren one. Luther and Calvin reverted to St. Augustine, retaining, however, only that part of his teaching which deals with the relation of the soul to God, not the part which is concerned with the Church. Their theology was such as to diminish the power of the Church. They abolished purgatory, from which the souls of the dead could be delivered by masses. They rejected the doctrine of indulgences, upon which a large part of the papal revenue depended. By the doctrine of predestination, the fate of the soul after death was made wholly independent of the actions of priests. These innovations, while they helped in the struggle with the Pope, prevented the Protestant churches from becoming as powerful in Protestant countries as the Catholic Church was in Catholic countries. Protestant divines were, at least at first, just as bigoted as Catholic theologians, but they had less power and were therefore less able to do harm. Almost from the very beginning, there was a division among Protestants as to the power of the state in religious matters. Luther was willing, wherever the prince was Protestant, to recognize him as head of the church in his own country. In England, Henry VIII and Elizabeth vigorously asserted their claims in this respect, and so did the Protestant princes of Germany, Scandinavia, and, after the revolt from Spain, Holland. This accelerated the already existing tendency to increase in the power of kings. But those Protestants who took seriously the individualistic aspects of the Reformation were as unwilling to submit to the king as to the Pope. The Anabaptists in Germany were suppressed, but their doctrine spread to Holland and England. The conflict between Cromwell and the Long Parliament had many aspects. In its theological aspect, it was in part a conflict between those who rejected and those who accepted the view that the state should decide in religious matters. Gradually, weariness resulting from the wars of religion led to the growth of belief in religious toleration, which was one of the sources of the movement which developed into 18th and 19th century liberalism. Protestant success, at first amazingly rapid, was checked mainly as a resultant of Loyola's creation of the Jesuit order. Loyola had been a soldier, and his order was founded on military models. There must be unquestioning obedience to the general, and every Jesuit was to consider himself engaged in warfare against heresy. As early as the Council of Trent, the Jesuits began to be influential. They were disciplined, able, completely devoted to the cause, and skillful propagandists. Their theology was the opposite of that of the Protestants. They rejected those elements of St. Augustine's teaching which the Protestants emphasized. They believed in free will and opposed predestination. Salvation was not by faith alone, but by both faith and works. The Jesuits acquired prestige by their missionary zeal, especially in the Far East. They became popular as confessors, because, if Pascal is to be believed, they were more lenient, except towards heresy, than other ecclesiastics. They concentrated on education, and thus acquired a firm hold on the minds of the young. Whenever theology did not interfere, the education they gave was the best obtainable. We shall see that they taught Descartes more mathematics than he would have learnt elsewhere. Politically, they were a single, united, disciplined body, shrinking from no dangers and no exertions. They urged Catholic princes to practice relentless persecution, and following in the wake of conquering Spanish armies, re-established the terror of the Inquisition, even in Italy, which had had nearly a century of free thought. The results of the Reformation and Counter-Reformation, in the intellectual sphere, were at first wholly bad, but ultimately beneficial. The 30 Years' War persuaded everybody that neither Protestants nor Catholics could be completely victorious. It became necessary to abandon the medieval hope of doctrinal unity, and this increased men's freedom to think for themselves, even about fundamentals. The diversity of creeds in different countries made it possible to escape persecution by living abroad. Disgust with theological warfare turned the attention of able men increasingly to secular learning, especially mathematics and science. These are among the reasons for the fact that, while the 16th century, after the rise of Luther, is philosophically barren, the 17th contains the greatest names and marks the most notable advance since Greek times. This advance began in science, with which I shall deal in my next chapter. Chapter 6. The Rise of Science. Almost everything that distinguishes the modern world from earlier centuries is attributable to science, which achieved its most spectacular triumphs in the 17th century. The Italian Renaissance, though not medieval, is not modern. It is more akin to the best age of Greece. The 16th century, with its absorption in theology, is more medieval than the world of Machiavelli. The modern world, so far as mental outlook is concerned, begins in the 17th century. No Italian of the Renaissance would have been unintelligible to Plato or Aristotle. Luther would have horrified Thomas Aquinas, but would not have been difficult for him to understand. With the 17th century, it is different. Plato and Aristotle, Aquinas and Occam, could not have made head or tail of Newton. The new conceptions that science introduced profoundly influenced modern philosophy. Descartes, who was in a sense the founder of modern philosophy, was himself one of the creators of 17th century science. Something must be said about the methods and results of astronomy and physics before the mental atmosphere of the time in which modern philosophy began can be understood. Four great men, Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, and Newton, are preeminent in the creation of science. Of these, Copernicus belongs to the 16th century, but in his own time he had little influence. Copernicus, 1473 to 1543, was a Polish ecclesiastic of unimpeachable orthodoxy. In his youth, he travelled in Italy and absorbed something of the atmosphere of the Renaissance. In 1500, he had a lectureship or professorship of mathematics in Rome. But in 1503, he returned to his native land, where he was a canon of Frauenberg. Much of his time seems to have been spent in combating the Germans and reforming the currency, but his leisure was devoted to astronomy. He came early to believe that the sun is at the centre of the universe, and that the earth has a twofold motion, a diurnal rotation and an annual revolution about the sun. Fear of ecclesiastical censure led him to delay publication of his views, though he allowed them to become known. His chief work, De Revolutionibus Orbium Coelestium, was published in the year of his death, 1543, with a preface by his friend Osiander, saying that the heliocentric theory was only put forward as a hypothesis. It is uncertain how far Copernicus sanctioned this statement, but the question is not very important, as he himself made similar statements in the body of the book.
He was now sending a plume of grey smoke into
and escaped official Catholic condemnation until the time of Galileo. The church in the lifetime of Copernicus was more liberal than it became after the Council of Trent. The Jesuits and the revived Inquisition had done their work. The atmosphere of Copernicus's work is not modern. It might rather be described as Pythagorean. He takes it as axiomatic that all celestial motions must be circular and uniform, and, like the Greeks, he allows himself to be influenced by aesthetic motives. There are still epicycles in his system, though their centres are at the sun, or rather near the sun. The fact that the sun is not exactly in the centre marred the simplicity of his theory. He does not seem to have known of Aristarchus's heliocentric theory, but there is nothing in his speculations that could not have occurred to a Greek astronomer. What was important in his work was the dethronement of the Earth from its geometrical preeminence. In the long run, this made it difficult to give to man the cosmic importance assigned to him in the Christian theology. But such consequences of his theory would not have been accepted by Copernicus, whose orthodoxy was sincere and who protested against the view that his theory contradicted the Bible. There were genuine difficulties in the Copernican theory. The greatest of these was the absence of stellar parallax. If the Earth at any one point of its orbit is 186 million miles from the point at which it will be in 6 months, this ought to cause a shift in the apparent positions of the stars. Just as a ship at sea, which is due north from one point of the coast, will not be due north from another. No parallax was observed, and Copernicus rightly inferred that the fixed stars must be very much more remote than the sun. It was not till the 19th century that the technique of measurement became sufficiently precise for stellar parallax to be observed, and then only in the case of a few of the nearest stars. Another difficulty arose as regards falling bodies. If the Earth is continually rotating from west to east, a body dropped from a height ought not to fall to a point vertically below its starting point, but to a point somewhat further west, since the Earth will have slipped away a certain distance during the time of the fall. To this difficulty, the answer was found by Galileo's law of inertia, but in the time of Copernicus, no answer was forthcoming. There is an interesting book by E.A. Burt called The Metaphysical Foundations of Modern Physical Science, 1925, which sets forth with much force the many unwarrantable assumptions made by the men who founded modern science. He points out quite truly that there were in the time of Copernicus no known facts which compelled the adoption of his system, and several which militated against it. Contemporary empiricists, had they lived in the 16th century, would have been the first to scoff out of court the new philosophy of the universe. The general purpose of the book is to discredit modern science by suggesting that its discoveries were lucky accidents, springing by chance from superstitions as gross as those of the Middle Ages. I think this shows a misconception of the scientific attitude. It is not what the man of science believes that distinguishes him, but how and why he believes it. His beliefs are tentative, not dogmatic. They are based on evidence, not on authority or intuition. Copernicus was right to call his theory a hypothesis. His opponents were wrong in thinking new hypotheses undesirable. The men who founded modern science had two merits which are not necessarily found together: immense patience in observation and great boldness in framing hypotheses. The second of these merits had belonged to the earliest Greek philosophers. The first existed to a considerable degree in the later astronomers of antiquity. But no one among the ancients, except perhaps Aristarchus, possessed both merits, and no one in the Middle Ages possessed either. Copernicus, like his great successors, possessed both. He knew all that could be known, with the instruments existing in his day, about the apparent motions of the heavenly bodies on the celestial sphere, and he perceived that the diurnal rotation of the Earth was a more economical hypothesis than the revolution of all the celestial spheres. According to modern views, which regard all motion as relative, simplicity is the only gain resulting from his hypothesis. But this was not his view, or that of his contemporaries. As regards the Earth's annual revolution, there was again a simplification, but not so notable a one as in the case of the diurnal rotation. Copernicus still needed epicycles, though fewer than were needed in the Ptolemaic system. It was not until Kepler discovered his laws that the new theory acquired its full simplicity. Apart from the revolutionary effect on cosmic imagination, the great merits of the new astronomy were two. First, the recognition that what had been believed since ancient times might be false. Second, that the test of scientific truth is patient collection of facts, combined with bold guessing as to laws binding the facts together. Neither merit is so fully developed in Copernicus as in his successors, but both are already present in a high degree in his work. Some of the men to whom Copernicus communicated his theory were German Lutherans, but when Luther came to know of it, he was profoundly shocked. "People give ear," he said, "to an upstart astrologer who strove to show that the earth revolves, not the heavens or the firmament, the sun and the moon. Whoever wishes to appear clever must devise some new system, which of all systems is of course the very best. This fool wishes to reverse the entire science of astronomy, but sacred scripture tells us that Joshua commanded the sun to stand still, and not the earth." Calvin similarly demolished Copernicus with the text, "The world also is established that it cannot be moved," and exclaimed, "Who will venture to place the authority of Copernicus above that of the Holy Spirit?" Protestant clergy were at least as bigoted as Catholic ecclesiastics. Nevertheless, there soon came to be much more liberty of speculation in Protestant than in Catholic countries, because in Protestant countries the clergy had less power. The important aspect of Protestantism was schism, not heresy. For schism led to national churches, and national churches were not strong enough to control the lay government. This was holy again, for the churches everywhere opposed as long as they could practically every innovation that made for an increase of happiness or knowledge here on earth. Copernicus was not in a position to give any conclusive evidence in favour of his hypothesis, and for a long time astronomers rejected it. The next astronomer of importance was Tycho Brahe, 1546 to 1601, who adopted an intermediate position. He held that the sun and moon go round the earth, but the planets go round the sun. As regards theory, he was not very original. He gave, however, two good reasons against Aristotle's view that everything above the moon is unchanging. One of these was the appearance of a new star in 1572, which was found to have no daily parallax and must therefore be more distant than the moon. The other reason was derived from observation of comets, which were also found to be distant. The reader will remember Aristotle's doctrine that change and decay are confined to the sublunary sphere. This, like everything else that Aristotle said on scientific subjects, proved an obstacle to progress. The importance of Tycho Brahe was not as a theorist, but as an observer, first under the patronage of the King of Denmark, then under the Emperor Rudolf II. He made a star catalogue and noted the positions of the planets throughout many years. Towards the end of his life, Kepler, then a young man, became his assistant. To Kepler, his observations were invaluable. Kepler, 1571 to 1630, is one of the most notable examples of what can be achieved by patience without much in the way of genius. He was the first important astronomer after Copernicus to adopt the heliocentric theory. But Tycho Brahe's data showed that it could not be quite right in the form given to it by Copernicus. He was influenced by Pythagoreanism and more or less fancifully inclined to sun worship, though a good Protestant. These motives, no doubt, gave him a bias in favour of the heliocentric hypothesis. His Pythagoreanism also inclined him to follow Plato's Timaeus in supposing that cosmic significance must attach to the five regular solids. He used them to suggest hypotheses to his mind. At last, by good luck, one of these worked. Kepler's great achievement was the discovery of his three laws of planetary motion. Two of these he published in 1609 and the third in 1619. His first law states, "The planets describe elliptic orbits, of which the sun occupies one focus." His second law states, "The line joining a planet to the sun sweeps out equal areas in equal times." His third law states, "The square of the period of revolution of a planet is proportioned to the cube of its average distance from the sun." Something must be said in explanation of the importance of these laws. The first two laws in Kepler's time could only be proved in the case of Mars. As regards the other planets, the observations were compatible with them, but not such as to establish them definitely. It was not long, however, before decisive confirmation was found. The discovery of the first law, that the planets move in ellipses, required a greater effort of emancipation from tradition than a modern man can easily realize. The one thing upon which all astronomers, without exception, had been agreed was that all celestial motions are circular, or compounded of circular motions. Where circles were found inadequate to explain planetary motions, epicycles were used. An epicycle is the curve traced by a point on a circle which rolls on another circle. For example, take a big wheel and fasten it flat on the ground. Take a smaller wheel, which has a nail through it, and roll the smaller wheel, also flat on the ground, round the big wheel, with the point of the nail touching the ground. Then the mark of the nail in the ground will trace out an epicycle. The orbit of the moon in relation to the sun is roughly of this kind. Approximately, the earth describes a circle round the sun, and the moon, meanwhile, describes a circle round the earth. But this is only an approximation. As observation grew more exact, it was found that no system of epicycles would exactly fit the facts. Kepler's hypothesis, he found, was far more closely in accord with the recorded positions of Mars than was that of Ptolemy or even that of Copernicus. The substitution of ellipses for circles involved the abandonment of the aesthetic bias which had governed astronomy ever since Pythagoras. The circle was a perfect figure, and the celestial orbs were perfect bodies, originally gods, and even in Plato and Aristotle, closely related to gods. It seemed obvious that a perfect body must move in a perfect figure. Moreover, since the heavenly bodies move freely, without being pushed or pulled, their motion must be natural. Now, it was easy to suppose that there is something natural about a circle, but not about an ellipse. Thus, many deep-seated prejudices had to be discarded before Kepler's first law could be accepted. No ancient, not even Aristarchus of Samos, had anticipated such an hypothesis. The second law deals with the varying velocity of the planet at different points of its orbit. If S is the Sun, and P1, P2, P3, P4, P5 are successive positions of the planet at equal intervals of time, say at intervals of a month, then Kepler's law states that the areas P1, S, P2, P2, S, P3, P3, S, P4, P4, S, P5 are all equal. The planet therefore moves fastest when it is nearest to the Sun and slowest when it is farthest from it. This again was shocking. A planet ought to be too stately to hurry at one time and dawdle at another. The third law was important because it compared the movements of different planets, whereas the first two laws dealt with the several planets singly. The third law says, if R is the average distance of a planet from the Sun, and T is the length of its year, then R cubed divided by T squared is the same for all the different planets. This law afforded the proof, as far as the solar system is concerned, of Newton's law of the inverse square for gravitation, but of this we shall speak later. Galileo, 1564 to 1642, is the greatest of the founders of modern science, with the possible exception of Newton. He was born on about the day on which Michelangelo died, and he died in the year in which Newton was born. I commend these facts to those, if any, who still believe in metempsychosis. He is important as an astronomer, but perhaps even more as the founder of dynamics. Galileo first discovered the importance of acceleration in dynamics. Acceleration means change of velocity, whether in magnitude or direction. Thus, a body moving uniformly in a circle has at all times an acceleration towards the center of the circle. In the language that had been customary before his time, we might say that he treated uniform motion in a straight line as alone natural, whether on earth or in the heavens. It had been thought natural for heavenly bodies to move in circles, and for terrestrial bodies to move in straight lines. But moving terrestrial bodies, it was thought, would gradually cease to move if they were let alone. Galileo held, as against this view, that everybody, if let alone, will continue to move in a straight line with uniform velocity. Any change, either in the rapidity or the direction of motion, requires to be explained as due to the action of some force. This principle was enunciated by Newton as the first law of motion. It is also called the law of inertia. I shall return to its purport later, but first something must be said as to the detail of Galileo's discoveries. Galileo was the first to establish the law of falling bodies. This law, given the concept of acceleration, is of the utmost simplicity. It says that when a body is falling freely, its acceleration is constant, except in so far as the resistance of the air may interfere. Further, the acceleration is the same for all bodies, heavy or light, great or small. The complete proof of this law was not possible until the air pump had been invented, which was about 1654. After this, it was possible to observe bodies falling in what was practically a vacuum, and it was found that feathers fell as fast as lead. What Galileo proved was that there is no measurable difference between large and small lumps of the same substance. Until his time, it had been supposed that a large lump of lead would fall much quicker than a small one. But Galileo proved by experiment that this is not the case. Measurement in his day was not such an accurate business as it has since become. Nevertheless, he arrived at the true law of falling bodies. If a body is falling freely in a vacuum, its velocity increases at a constant rate. At the end of the first second, its velocity will be 32 feet per second. At the end of another second, 64 feet per second. At the end of the third, 96 feet per second, and so on. The acceleration, that is, the rate at which the velocity increases, is always the same. In each second, the increase of velocity is approximately 32 feet per second. Galileo also studied projectiles, a subject of importance to his employer, the Duke of Tuscany. It had been thought that a projectile fired horizontally will move horizontally for a while and then suddenly begin to fall vertically. Galileo showed that apart from the resistance of the air, the horizontal velocity would remain constant, in accordance with the law of inertia, but a vertical velocity would be added, which would grow according to the law of falling bodies. To find out how the projectile will move during some short time, say a second, after it has been in flight for some time, we proceed as follows. First, if it were not falling, it would cover a certain horizontal distance, equal to that which it covered in the first second of its flight. Second, if it were not moving horizontally, but merely falling, it would fall vertically with a velocity proportional to the time since the flight began. In fact, its change of place is what it would be if it first moved horizontally for a second with the initial velocity, and then fell vertically for a second with a velocity proportional to the time during which it has been in flight. A simple calculation shows that its consequent course is a parabola, and this is confirmed by observation, except in so far as the resistance of the air interferes. The above gives a simple instance of a principle which proved immensely fruitful in dynamics, the principle that, when several forces act simultaneously, the effect is as if each acted in turn. This is part of a more general principle called the parallelogram law. Suppose, for example, that you're on the deck of a moving ship and you walk across the deck. While you are walking, the ship has moved on, so that in relation to the water, you have moved both forward and across the direction of the ship's motion. If you want to know where you will have got to in relation to the water, you may suppose that first you stood still while the ship moved, and then for an equal time the ship stood still while you walked across it. The same principle applies to forces. This makes it possible to work out the total effect of a number of forces and makes it feasible to analyze physical phenomena, discovering the separate laws of the several forces to which moving bodies are subject. It was Galileo who introduced this immensely fruitful method. In what I have been saying, I have tried to speak as nearly as possible in the language of the 17th century. Modern language is different in important respects, but to explain what the 17th century achieved, it is desirable to adopt its modes of expression for the time being. The law of inertia explained a puzzle which, before Galileo, the Copernican system had been unable to explain. As observed above, if you drop a stone from the top of a tower, it will fall at the foot of the tower, not somewhere to the west of it. Yet, if the earth is rotating, it ought to have slipped away a certain distance during the fall of the stone. The reason this does not happen is that the stone retains the velocity of rotation which, before being dropped, it shared with everything else on the earth's surface. In fact, if the tower were high enough, there would be the opposite effect to that expected by the opponents of Copernicus. The top of the tower, being further from the center of the earth than the bottom, is moving faster, and therefore the stone should fall slightly to the east of the foot of the tower. This effect, however, would be too slight to be measurable. Galileo ardently adopted the heliocentric system. He corresponded with Kepler and accepted his discoveries. Having heard that a Dutchman had lately invented a telescope, Galileo made one himself and very quickly discovered a number of important things. He found that the Milky Way consists of a multitude of separate stars. He observed the phases of Venus, which Copernicus knew to be implied by his theory, but which the naked eye was unable to perceive. He discovered the satellites of Jupiter, which in honor of his employer he called Sidera Medicea. It was found that these satellites obey Kepler's laws. There was, however, a difficulty. There had always been seven heavenly bodies, the five planets and the sun and moon. Now seven is a sacred number. Is not the Sabbath the seventh day? Were there not the seven branched candlesticks and the seven churches of Asia? What then could be more appropriate than that there should be seven heavenly bodies? But if we have to add Jupiter's four moons, that makes 11, a number which has no mystic properties. On this ground, the traditionalists denounced the telescope, refused to look through it, and maintained that it revealed only delusions. Galileo wrote to Kepler, wishing they could have a good laugh together at the stupidity of the mob. The rest of his letter makes it plain that the mob consisted of the professors of philosophy who tried to conjure away Jupiter's moons using logic-chopping arguments as though they were magical incantations. Galileo, as everyone knows, was condemned by the Inquisition, first privately in 1616, and then publicly in 1633, on which latter occasion he recanted and promised never again to maintain that the earth rotates or revolves. The Inquisition was successful in putting an end to science in Italy, which did not revive there for centuries. But it failed to prevent men of science from adopting the heliocentric theory, and did considerable damage to the church by its stupidity. Fortunately, there were Protestant countries where the clergy, however anxious to do harm to science, were unable to gain control of the state. Newton, 1642 to 1727, achieved the final and complete triumph for which Copernicus, Kepler, and Galileo had prepared the way. Starting from his three laws of motion, of which the first two are due to Galileo, he proved that Kepler's three laws are equivalent to the proposition that every planet, at every moment, has an acceleration towards the sun, which varies inversely as the square of the distance from the sun. He showed that accelerations towards the Earth and the sun, following the same formula, explain the moon's motion, and that the acceleration of falling bodies on the Earth's surface is again related to that of the moon according to the inverse square law. He defined force as the cause of change of motion, that is, of acceleration. He was thus able to enunciate his law of universal gravitation. Every body attracts every other with a force directly proportional to the product of their masses and inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them. From this formula, he was able to deduce everything in planetary theory: the motions of the planets and their satellites, the orbits of comets, the tides. It appeared later that even the minute departures from elliptical orbits on the part of the planets were deducible from Newton's law. The triumph was so complete that Newton was in danger of becoming another Aristotle and imposing an insuperable barrier to progress. In England, it was not till a century after his death that men freed themselves from his authority sufficiently to do important original work in the subjects of which he had treated. The 17th century was remarkable, not only in astronomy and dynamics, but in many other ways connected with science. Take first the question of scientific instruments. The compound microscope was invented just before the 17th century, about 1590. The telescope was invented in 1608 by a Dutchman named Lippershey, though it was Galileo who first made serious use of it for scientific purposes.